electric bass. Played it with finesse and grace. Set on
four. It's a matter of time, I suppose.
Welcome back to Watchmen Minute, where we're examining the director's cut of Zack Snyder's Watchmen 1 minute at a time. My name is Travis Bowe from the Real Comic Heroes podcast.
I'm Eric Nash from the upcoming in 2019 Almost Famous Minute.
And I am Connor Coulson from Prometheus by Minute.
Welcome back, Connor.
Great to be back.
Back to talk about some more Adrian and his schemes.
My boy.
This is minute 147, which starts with Adrian thanking his scientists and ends with Rorschach dropping off his journal.
Thank you for being a friend.
Yeah.
I think that song would have been more appropriate in the scene. You know, Snyder was picking songs from this era, and I feel like that would have been perfect.
Yeah. I smell an edit. Fan edit coming on.
I must do it myself.
Yeah.
Also, sorry for subjecting you to my singing. I can't really... I've got headphones on, so I can't really hear myself properly, so it's probably even worse than normal. My first note is, dat cape. I know Edna Mode says no capes, but... I love, this is a really iconic moment to me that it just drapes over these dead bodies. He just wanders through, and I think that cape really, it's a central focus of this scene, and what it conveys to me is just a kind of indifference, the way this fabric is just draping over these bodies. It's so striking.
And it's interesting because over the last few years, it feels like every cape we've seen has been CGI over the last couple of years. You know, Superman, yeah. Batman.
Vision.
Yeah, Vision. Probably Thor. Maybe not always. I feel like some of the Thor
is practical for the most part. What they do is the top, what they call the mantle of the cape, is they sort of have a stunt one. Maybe we can dig up some photos. But yeah, so for Loki and Thor, the top part is real in those action scenes, but then they will add the rest of the cape on.
Sure.
So it's like a 20% real cape.
Cool. Well, this one, yeah, I would say is 100% real.
Oh, yeah, and it's definitely velvet as well.
Oh, yeah.
Which... that must have been really difficult working with that crushed color palette that Snyder uses, because velvet's always a difficult fabric to work with. It's a very fascinating fabric. I could talk about the history of that and how it, you know, it's got the long history right back to the medieval age, or well, the Elizabethan age, to be more precise. But just the way it works in terms of physics, the way it reflects light, especially on camera, is so fascinating to me. And the biggest learning curve was, so I used to be very into Doctor Who, and I would cosplay as the Paul McGann Doctor, so the Eighth Doctor.
Okay.
And that was, the movie was not filmed in the highest quality, let's just say. I think it was basically a VHS camera. And so for years and years and years, fans would debate, no, his jacket's green, no, it's gold, no, it's brown, black, da-da-da-da-da. They finally, for the 50th anniversary, actually found the jacket and took photos of it under even light with modern cameras. It's green. Huh. But people would have these intense debates and show photos and you go, oh yeah, it does look like that. Same thing with this cape, or just actually Ozymandias' costume in general. It's because the colors are so muted. You go, is that purple? Is that burgundy? I think that's really cool. I don't know if anyone else thinks that's cool, but I'm nerding out about it.
A similar thing happens for in Empire Strikes Back with Han's coat at the beginning on Hoth.
Oh,
it,
yeah.
It even happened for the action figure, that it was blue. It was blue there, but then it turned out it's really a brown.
Huh. Yeah, the merchandise often ends up being the thing that confuses everyone, because you would assume, oh well, they obviously knew what they were doing. No.
Yeah, right.
Wow, how does it go from brown to blue? Sorry to tangent, but what's happening? How does the okay? Yeah, this is the kind of stuff I really think in depth about.
Yeah.
And I kind of appreciate that with other aspects of, well, filmmaking or just art in general. This, when someone just goes, oh yeah, and this is why, you know, we angled the set like this because it creates this illusion. You go, oh yeah, it does too.
Hmm.
Like this scene, I'm looking at the set and I'm going, there's a lot of, I can't speak to it myself. I wish I could, but I know there's a lot of clever stuff going on with the, I guess, geometry or the angles of this scene, that you've got this staircase and then the walls to the sides of that staircase, you know, sweeping away.
Yeah.
And then the, the panels are on a certain angle, then all the piping is this beautiful symmetry. Like, I kind of understand in layman's terms, like, there's a lot of thought going on here. I just don't know what it is exactly. It looks good.
Yeah.
Do you have at least 10 dead bodies to get rid of? Well, do I have the solution for you?
Yeah, it's interesting that we see this intrinsic field generator, that apparently they've perfected it or figured out a way to have that field generator not be contained within a room, you know, like we saw earlier in the movie. So it just teleports all these bodies away, or at least dematerializes them. Removes them from this this little hallway and
this plane of reality.
Yeah, yeah. It'd be interesting to find out where those bodies went.
On the underside of a raft floating to a New England town.
Yeah.
That's fucked up.
We start off like you were saying about the seeing the cape kind of as he's moving away, and then you get this. I'm a first time watcher of the movie. Where the hell does this cat thing, as Scott Carelli called it way back when, where does this cat thing come from? You know?
Yeah. Every single little suggestion from the comics, not here.
Yeah, like briefly they talked about the whole genetic engineering thing in that interview, but that's not enough to, that's a big leap to go from an hour and a half ago, a small line about genetic engineering. That's a big leap to go, here's this great big tiger, blue tiger thing with,
is this,
you know,
the first time she's shown up in the movie?
It is, yeah.
Oh my god, wowee. Yeah. Okay, yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
What are you doing, guys?
Yeah, it's almost, I kind of just wish, if you're gonna show her here, put her in the interview scene earlier on, like she's laying in the corner in a, you know, just standing guard, that kind of thing. Like, just, it feels weird to introduce this Bubastis, you know, so late.
Yeah, she absolutely should have been at that interview, or I don't even think they talk about Bubastis action figures.
In
that scene.
Yeah,
that's another option.
Yeah.
Why were there no Bubastis plush toys? That Adrian.
Yeah.
Get in on that.
It's a Beanie Baby Bubastis toys.
Surely someone's done that.
Yeah.
But first of all, I like that she's purple instead of orange now, so that's even more on brand for
sure.
White. But yeah, it really wouldn't have been that difficult to just add that in an earlier scene just to sort of introduce her, even in the briefest way. And there isn't even a deleted scene. No.
No.
Yeah, really? Yeah, okay. The other thing... Oh, God. Oh, yes. So the whole genetic augmentation is... It was a much more important detail in the graphic novel because you needed to imply that technology exists so that you can have yourself a big old squiddly diddly third act. But here I guess it doesn't really matter. And then I thought, why didn't they just throw all of that out? But gave it a bit more thought and went, it kind of becomes a red herring in that sense, because you go, oh, has Adrian modified himself?
Oh.
Are we going to find out that he's got superhuman powers? Is he going to be a bit of a syndrome? Like, when everyone has power, when everyone's special, no one will be.
That would have been kind of interesting, yeah.
Yeah, but play that up more and introduce Bubastis and missed opportunity.
Yeah. So Bubastis is also known in Arabic as Telbasta, or in Egyptian as Perbast, which is an ancient Egyptian city. The phrase means House of Bast. Bast was originally a fierce lioness warrior goddess of the sun throughout most of ancient Egyptian history, but later changed into a cat goddess that is familiar today, becoming Bastet.
He knew what he was doing.
Yeah. Pretty easy to understand why he would name his big fake kitty Bubastis.
I hope he calls her Boob for short. so we cut to... I don't know if we should jump ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to ask if anything else on Karnak.
Well, as far as what he's saying during this, after we change to this minute, you know, I mean, this is, but this is where we find out he killed them.
Truly. Oh, yeah.
And then later on, with what Warshak says, I'd like to just point out, though, that Adrian seemingly might not be willing to give up his own life. But then what we find out later in this minute, I mean, it's mirrored just like some of the visuals here that we can get to in a minute as well, Warshak is. I mean, Warshak later here says, you know, whether I'm alive or dead.
Mm, yeah.
That, tying back to what I was saying about all these characters being deeply flawed, but having certain either admirable qualities or qualities you can understand, Rorschach, as scary as he is, there is something about his absolute dedication to his principles that is admirable, that he is absolutely willing to die for his beliefs, and... On one hand, that's respectable, but also kind of terrifying.
Well, and especially when he's willing to die for his beliefs, and as we've seen throughout the early part of the movie, his beliefs are very dark and skewed towards, he has a very extreme right bent towards his views and his morality and so
it's
is
very
that
hard to put him in any conventional political camp.
Sure.
He's doing his own thing.
Yeah. But that's maybe a little scarier when he'll die for his beliefs and convictions.
Where by contrast, I have to wonder, Adrian, well, especially the film version, seems rather arrogant, narcissistic. I think he does love himself a bit. And I can't imagine himself dying, especially before seeing the culmination of his plans.
Sure.
But then, why name yourself Ozymandias? See, that's the true irony there. And I keep coming back. This is something I've been thinking about. Probably, it's about 10 years, maybe more, just going, Okay, so he's a very educated man. He definitely knows the ironic Byronic intentions behind that poem. And maybe that's too obscure. Okay, in Alien Covenant, David thinks that the poem is by Percy Shelley, and then it's by Byron, but it's Percy Shelley.
Mm-hmm.
Shit. No, that's way too obscure. God damn it, Connor. You're making jokes on that you understand. Okay, just delete that. I do that all the time, though, where I make these really obscure references and realize, wait, I'm the only one who would remember that. So Adrian would definitely understand the irony in Shelley's poem. So I can conclude, well, I guess one of two or three things. One, that he is absolutely at peace with the idea that nothing is permanent and that even he will not remain. You know, that he, no matter what he accomplishes, no matter how big of an empire, it all erodes to sand. And there is one passage, it goes on for a bit, but I'll try to keep it as brief as possible, in the graphic novel, issue 11, page 22, if you are reading along. Each step had to be taken care of. I should give some back. So he is talking to Night Owl and Rorschach, who have just shown up at Karnak. Each step had to be taken carefully, constantly striving to keep in mind the enormous scale of what was at stake. The Earth, humanity, all we've ever known. End of the world does the concept no justice. The world's present would end. Its future, immeasurably vaster, would also vanish. Even our past would be cancelled. Our struggle from the primal ooze, every childbirth, every personal sacrifice, rendered meaningless, leading only to dust tossed on the void winds. Tossed on the void winds is a very unusual word, but yes, void winds is what he says. Sounds like you're trying to politely say that you're trying to relieve yourself. A little bit of, just got a, got a bit of pressure here. Oh, void wins. Anyway, the final part I think is a bit amusing. Save for Richard Nixon, whose name adorns a plaque upon the moon, no human vestige would remain. Ruins become sand, sand blows away. All our richness and color and beauty would be lost as if it had never been. And then we do get a brief panel of the end of the Black Freighter, which is apparently supposed to embody Adrian's fears of paranoia and fear and building up this idea of an enemy or a danger that may actually not exist.
Sure.
And causing all sorts of horror and hurting even those he cares about. Does he care about anyone? I don't know. But yeah, that's basically what that allegory was about. So what I conclude from that is that he is very aware that everything will turn to ash, but at the same time, he's afraid of that happening. So then could we say that he is arrogant, assuming that, or even being ironic, that he goes, yeah, I'm going to name myself Ozymandias, but unlike the King of Kings, I will not be remembered merely by a broken statue. I don't... It's such a... You could go on analysing it forever, but I would really love to know Alan Moore's intention, but all my digging has thus far proven fruitless. Most people just want to talk to him about Rorschach.
Sure.
Lord knows why. He's clearly not the coolest character.
Yeah, I haven't looked into much of the Ozymandias stuff yet. I've definitely read the initial, you know, first bit of the poem and stuff. But I guess we'll be coming up to it pretty soon when we kind of get more of that stuff. So,
but maybe it really is. It is a threatening message. Look upon my works, ye mighty, and despair. And it's used so wonderfully in Alien Covenant. I think that's for David to say that as he's wiping out an entire planet of people. Yeah, that's when you use it. But I mean, thankfully, Adrian never says that. You know, his most quotable line after his mission is successful is that I did it 35 minutes ago, which it is my dream to have an opportunity to say that. And I kind of did recently.
Oh, yeah.
But I thought of it after the fact and I was alone, so I said it to myself. It was quite sad. I didn't even remember. I wish I knew the specifics, but it was just, I don't know, something mundane like bringing in the laundry from outside. And I was like, I already did it 35 minutes ago, but I didn't think of it at the time. Let's see, what else did I have on my notes? Oh, yes. The other one is... So, basically, my theories break down into false humility, memento mori, and hubristic impermanence. And thank you for coming to my TED Talk. And, those will be elaborated on in my essay.
Nice. Should we jump over to Rorschach?
Yeah, I'm trying to see if there was anything else that I'd missed. No, yeah, I'm up to Rorschach now. Yes, got it. I've got Adrian out of my system, probably, mostly, no guarantees.
So Rorschach, we get some voiceover. Rorschach's journal, final entry. And I think it's interesting that he says final entry because it works on... two, maybe more levels. One, he's physically delivering this journal to the New Frontiersman, the newspaper. So he won't be adding anything else to this volume or this, you know, physical copy of the journal. It's out of his hands now. He's putting it out and, you know, trusting that this paper that he, you know, respects so much, that they're going to do the right thing in Rorschach's eyes and carry on his, not his work, but just his...
the calls?
Call. Yeah, sort of. And then two, from here on in, for the main narrative of the movie, we're not going to have any more voiceovers. So it kind of, as we enter into the... I think we start to enter into the third act of the movie here. And
I'd say so, yeah.
You know, it's all going to be now we know that Adrian is kind of the bad guy, and it's going to be Dan and Rorschach heading out to try and stop him, and what he says, you know, next about, you know, him being a dangerous opponent and that kind of stuff. And he... Eric, like you said, you know, whether I'm alive or dead. So it really is, you know, this whole final entry thing really works.
Even this scene, which, you know, it's just a journal being dropped into a mail basket. The lighting is so epic. You start off with, it's nighttime, obviously, it's dark, there's only one little pink light on the left of the screen. And as you zoom in, the Archie comes down, this is obviously the headlights illuminating the room as if it were daytime. And yeah, there's a real, there's that sepia tone that Zack Snyder is known for. And just everything about it is really epic, even though it isn't anything. Well, in some ways, it's a very significant moment, and in other ways, it's not. Like, there aren't even any human players in this scene. And I really like comparing Snyder to Michael Bay. Because both of them are... They have a history... I think Snyder does, yeah. Have a history with commercials. Very sure. Bold, epic... action-oriented visual styles. But I think Snyder does it better because he isn't chaotic. He knows when to make a moment matter. He does... I think he lacks subtlety and restraint in a lot of ways, like in the action scenes of... It's very strange. Watchmen is, the graphic novel, mostly bloodless.
Sure.
And then you see the carnage, of the octopus in New York. Whereas this is the opposite. You see a lot of blood and violence and gore and all that.
Yeah.
And then a very bloodless New York. But then other times he really does know when to just strike that balance. And I think this scene really typifies it, that it's epic. It feels significant, but it's not crowded or messy or chaotic. I can hear a cat agreeing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Is that Bubastis?
Yeah.
Yeah,
Bubastis.
I would love it if Bubastis had like the tiniest little kitty. Yes, we tried to perfect the vocal cords, but this is the best we could do. Oh, man. Do you think they went through a lot of prototype Bubastis?
Oh.
Oh, God. Yes, we got tired of having to shoot, you know, so many cats.
Oh, my God, no.
So many cats.
All the genetic, like, or all the little monster, like,
oh, yeah,
half-cooked ones that didn't quite work.
Kill me. Oh, no.
Yeah. Yikes. So, yeah, Rorschach says that, you know, Veidt's behind everything. And he says he used to joke he was fast enough to catch a bullet. And who joked? Adrian joked that he was fast enough, like bragging, sort of? Or Rorschach joked that he was fast enough? Because...
Yeah, he doesn't use a pronoun.
It's the understood I or understood he.
Yeah, I don't...
I think that Adrian would definitely, like, if there's a lull in the conversation, just like, by the way, I mean, I've never done it, but I bet. Guys, listen, hear me out.
Yeah. I could be going back more to that that marketing thing. You know, we know from the book he was a bit of a circus act, you know, a bit of a... He would put on displays, you know. He would do the shows on TV and acrobatics and stuff like that. So maybe they marketed him as, like, you know, he's fast enough to catch a bullet.
Yeah, probably. And then there's also a kind of a Charles Atlas aspect to him. So maybe there was even, you know, the little advertisements in comic books and stuff saying, you know, he's the world's smartest man and he can also catch a bullet because his reflexes are so fast. Now, while you could never be as good as him, of course, you could, yeah.
Subscribe to the Veidt method. My
12-week, yeah. Which I think is actually in the Before Watchmen. They talk about that.
Well, it's in here in the movie. You can see a couple posters of it, and you can see on the back of the comic book that the teenager's reading outside the newsstand, instead of the Charles Atlas, you know, whatever that one was, that advertisement, it is literally the Adrian, the Veidt method is on the back of that comic book.
I could actually see that. Well, so we never see a movie Adrian shirtless or anything. We don't really get a true sense of his physique, and also the armor or costume really builds him up. But yeah, I could imagine he's not actually like this big, bulky superhero. He's more like, kind of like Bruce Lee. Like, if you saw Bruce Lee just walking down the street wearing a jacket, you wouldn't think, oh yeah, this guy is like superhuman. So that real lithe, very lean muscle mass, I could imagine he probably does a lot of fasting and deep meditation and like Bikram yoga and all that sort of stuff. So I think Adrian's approach to fitness and training would probably be very Eastern inspired, but scientifically inspired as well. So, maybe he wouldn't have a physique that you would imagine. And also these would be principles that the Western world had never heard of. So easy way to make some money that way too.
Sure.
Going back to this journal, in the graphic novel I noticed this time around is also, I love this show. It's really brought me back to a very particular moment in my life when I was a teen. We'll talk about that later. when I go into my history with Watchmen, but just, yeah, returning to the graphic novel, watching the movie again 10 years later almost, it's been a great experience. And then your commentary as well, this story's come to life again in a whole new way. But yes, so the journal, I noticed Rorschach mentions his handwriting is not great.
Yeah.
Someone else sees the journal and goes, this is barely legible, or they can't read it at all. And then when he drops this book off, he does mention, I've tried to make this as clear as possible. But now I have this sense of, because when I read it the first time, I just went, oh, yeah, I guess the New Frontier finds it. And the real question there is, do they think it's true? Do they publish it? Do they think it's a load of bullshit and just throw it out? No, the real variable that this is hinging on is it even legible? Or will people flick through this dirty old book and just go, I don't even want to touch this? And it seems like it's written in Sanskrit.
Yeah. Well, and if we're taking what we're hearing as that's what's literally in the journal, like that's what's being written down, and we have to play with that a little bit because we have voiceover that continues after the journal drops into the basket. So we have to assume that what we're hearing is what was written but is being read kind of after the fact, sort of. And so he says all this stuff about, you know, Veidt's behind everything, everything that we've talked about, and says, you know, we're going to Antarctica. And then continues with, whether I'm alive or dead upon this reading, I hope the world survives long enough for this journal to reach you. And then, you know, he says the stuff about compromise and all that. And how about some facts, Rorschach? Like, you're putting this out there, like, we're going to go stop Veidt because he's dangerous and he could kill us in the snow. But he doesn't say, like, Veidt killed Eddie, or is behind the death of Eddie Blake. Veidt is behind the disappearance of Dr. Manhattan. Like, he doesn't provide any
assassination on himself. Yeah.
Yeah. So
it's everything.
I guess it's, well, everything. It may have been omitted. Maybe it's a little further back in the journal. We just didn't hear it, but yeah, maybe it's implying that he's just so convinced of his beliefs that he neglected to actually provide evidence. He felt it was so self-evident that of course Adrian Veidt is behind all of this. Yeah, wow, actually that
or is it in the journal but we're not hearing that part of the narration? So it's weird. I don't know where the narration stops and the journal begins, or vice versa.
That's an advantage of, well, books in general, but, you know, for Watchmen, they planned it so intricately and specifically that you're not worried about time, or maybe space, but you can take your time to really include every single detail you really want, whereas, yeah, the film has to move at a certain pace, and a lot of films, I find, it's more implication rather than, you know, actual text, subtext rather than text. So, yeah, that is another layer of ambiguity there.
Yeah.
Also, totally random, I just remembered because it was an episode I listened to last, I defend the smartest man on the Cinder line. I like it. Because, the smartest man on the dumpster fire. I really did spend the rest of the afternoon going, what else would you say?
Yeah.
Smartest man on the dumpster fire is my second favorite choice.
So I had some, since Rorschach brings it up, and we did get to see a little sneak peek of it yesterday, we see, you know, Antarctica. Yeah, that's, Rorschach says that's where we're going now. So just a few notes about Antarctica. It's about twice the size of Australia. It is a desert. That's
pretty damn big.
There are anywhere from 1,000 to 5,000 people who reside there throughout the year in various research stations. And the Antarctic Treaty of 1959 prohibits military activities and mineral mining and prohibits nuclear explosions or nuclear waste disposal. So it's kind of just an agreed upon continent for science and research.
So I guess that when Adrian was building Karnak, he probably would have had to declare it as a research facility.
Sure.
Whether he even planned to do any research there or not. It really just sort of feels like maybe that is a direct reference, a fortress of solitude. It's just a place to put all these fancy stuff and brood and look amazing.
Well, he even says in that interview earlier on something about the work he's doing with Dr. Manhattan and his energy. He says, I'm about to make a breakthrough in energy. I think he even says Antarctica. And of course, we have the little video, the scene between Laurie and John when Adrian's kind of in the background on TV, and we know that they're working with each other.
I do have a friend who did go to Antarctica to research penguins.
Oh, okay.
And I think she wrote her thesis on like the reproductive cycle of this very specific breed of penguin that I didn't even know existed. But seeing photos and just the sort of things you have to do to just live there, it's another world. It really does feel like another planet. You know, saying you went to Antarctica is akin to saying you went to Mars. You go, right.
Yeah.
Random note. So I was between episodes, I was mentioning this. So just diving into Adrian's philosophy a bit more. I was talking about, you know, conquest and peace and stuff being interchangeable. Well, Adrian says here, while he's poisoning his servants, adopting Ramesses II's Greek name and Alexander's freebooting style, I resolved to apply antiquity's teachings to today's world. Thus began my path to conquest. Conquest not of men, but of the evils that beset them. Yeah, it is this sort of... It's sort of the same philosophy there. He just has this idea of, I am the one who can fix these problems, and evil is a thing that is... It's almost childlike to assume evil is this one thing.
Yeah.
That I alone can solve as one entity. So that's another part of his character that fascinates me, is just how he simplifies things. And I'm wondering if that's a little bit like how you get that with the Fantastic Four comics. Reed Richards or Doctor Doom really simplify these very complex concepts. And from the outside you go, well, okay, that's a bit childish and that's really simplifying things. But I don't know, if you are that intelligent, maybe everything does become that simple.
Yeah.
And you start thinking in these broad strokes. You sort of, yeah, like the intelligence scale is you think in broad strokes, and then when you're sort of in average intelligence or above average intelligence, things become very complicated and you understand the nuances. And then maybe if you're this superhuman genius, you suddenly go, actually, everything is the equation of A plus B divided by X. It's so obvious. I mean, you guys are all idiots. So yeah, I don't know.
Any other notes or thoughts on this one? I'm at the end of my notes.
I've got some random ones. Okay. That, yeah, did Adrian kill his parents? That's always been a mystery to me, because I feel like that was the implication. It's a little too convenient.
Sure. I could see, yeah. And going back to what you were saying about we only hear Adrian's history from Adrian, and it could have easily been his past could have been completely different, but this is the marketing side of Adrian. This is the history that he presents. So yeah, I could easily see or believe that Adrian had something to do with their death.
Yeah, and the only motivation I can think of is, of course, money. Now, he claims he got rid of it all and decided, oh, I'm going to go on this, soul-searching journey. Well, I wish they mentioned in the movie that, yes, soul-searching journey where he gets naked and get high on weed,
yeah,
and has a revelation. That was a very important detail that I felt was missing. But I actually feel like he is not as noble as he claims, and perhaps went, I need money to do this very particular thing. My parents don't know what they're doing with their money. I don't think they were especially wealthy, were they?
Yeah, I think it's implied that there was some... Well, I know I've talked about this, and I know that Matthew Good either decided or made it his own headcanon, and the way he's going to play Adrian is that his family or his parents were wealthy because of wealth that was stolen from Jews from the concentration camps or just in Nazi-controlled Germany. And so there's a lot of guilt there, and part of that giving away of his wealth is driven by a little bit of wanting to get rid of that money that came by those means. So I remember reading that's how Matthew Good decided to play or just kept that like in his head as far as when he would talk about his parents and his wealth.
Actually, going back and reading all the interviews and watching the interviews he gave at the time, you know, because I really originally just went, no, this is too different from the comic. I don't like this version of Adrian, and throw it out. But yeah, I have come to appreciate it more as its own thing. That there are similarities between the characters, book and film, yeah, but they don't have to be the same. You don't even have to compare them to one another. I think as its own entity, the film Ozymandias does have a lot to give. And he did give it a lot, Matthew gave it a lot of thought, and
sure,
I think he sort of gave it some new layers there that weren't there in the original text. So yeah, thank you guys. You've helped me appreciate how I learned to stop worrying and appreciate the Matthew Good version of Ozymandias.
That's why we're here.
Totally random, but the boys' folder is another interesting mystery about dear Adrian. It may have just been a random code name for whatever, but fans have speculated for so long, like, is there porn in there? I bet it's porn. That's pretty much as deep as the theories go.
I guess I'm... Where do you, is this folder... show up?
It's, you see it on the desktop of Adrian's computer.
Okay.
In both the graphic novel and the film. So in just, I think it's a few minutes prior to this one where...
Last week when Rorschach and Dan are...
Sure.
Snooping about. So
it's very minor, like blinking you'll miss it. But so many fans have just focused on that going, that's a very specific name. Is that supposed to make us think
something of certain untoward
things? Nefarious?
Right,
yeah.
Right. Okay.
And that's another thing is the depths of the, I don't want to say depravity, but the depths of Adrian's moral ambiguity. It seems to vary greatly from reader to reader or viewer to viewer. Like, some really do think, oh, he's a real piece of shit and he's probably, you know, killed his parents. He's got child pornography in his computer. He's got this, that, it, yeah. Which is, I think, all of these characters, you can really take a very negative view of them or maybe a bit more balanced, or you can sort of I don't know why people do this, but it even have kind of a hero worship of some of these characters. I will not name names or be specific, but well, I guess I'm being a bit of a hypocrite. I know Adrian's not a good guy, but just think he looks really cool, and you know, don't judge me.
Sure.
But yeah, Rorschach's definitely another one.
Yeah, he's
characters there. Oh, he's so cool. He's right. Like Batman.
Yeah.
And that's why I love this story, both book and film, and probably why people come back to it over and over again, is these aren't just characters. These are vessels of moral debate and personal judgment.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Why do we keep coming up with essay titles? Watchmen, vessels for moral judgment.
Yeah.
In doing research for this, I kept coming across, you know, videos on YouTube from the way back times of 2009, which I'm amazed to find YouTube did exist back then. I found my own comments in some of the... no, I don't want to know what 17-year-old Connor was thinking. Wow. Oh, he was an idiot.
That's funny. I'm looking at myself.
Oh, yeah. It was like time travel.
Yeah, yeah.
They changed this in the movie, so the movie's crap.
I'm looking at myself in 2009, and I'm oh, and I'm no, being yes, a troll on YouTube. At the same time, I'm in 2018, and I'm on a podcast.
I had a note in the next minute, which sadly I will not be here for, but I understand that. Yeah, so I'm understanding these characters in a new way now, and one of them with John is, how strange must it be that the moment you meet someone, or even before you meet them, you know when they'll die? And that must be why, I think in a way, that's sort of why he became so aloof. It's just like, I know the end of everything and everyone.
Sure.
Oh, that's not related, but I guess, yeah, I have seen my old comments on Prometheus videos too, and it's the same thing of just...
Right.
Kids should not be allowed to make comments on the internet. I think you have to be at least 21
yeah.
before you can make comments on the internet.
Sir, do you have your internet license on you?
Yeah.
I don't have to see that
Yeah,
now.
Forget am I a robot, because actually, no, you want the robots.
Yeah.
The robots know how to make comments, and literate comments at that. But, I mean, they're trying to sell you Viagra or whatever, but yeah, internet license. That's my idea. Yeah. That's how we save the world, gentlemen.
Okay. any last thoughts on this this minute?
Yeah, I'm done.
Okay. Connor, tell us about, I mean, you certainly have a lot of history with Watchmen. Can you tell us about the first time you read the book?
Yeah, I would actually go so far as to say it's one of those stories that was fundamental for me. That really, you know, either it just came into my life at the right time, or it was very foundational in my way of seeing the world, or it just continues to influence me to this day, and I reread it. One example would be Frankenstein, and the other one is definitely Watchmen. And the first time I read Watchmen, I was just getting into comics, and it was definitely one of those ones that everyone said, you need to read this, this is the most important one. My uncle actually runs a comic book shop, and I grew up on Doctor Strange comics and stuff like that. But, you know, I was around 14 and trying to get more into the more mature comics and stuff like that. So I got this battered old copy, which I still have right here, which smells funny, but the colors have so beautifully faded. I will never get rid of this copy because the colors just, love them. They're sort of a pastel shade now. And I think it just you know, 14 years old, I was only just starting to think for myself. I was raised Catholic and I was sort of questioning religion and starting to get interested in science and philosophy and all of that. And here was this comic that really encapsulated not only those elements, but of other aspects of culture, comics and movies and old serials, fashion, advertising. It was just, it seemed to me like a critique on everything about, well, still modern life. I think it's still saying things that are relevant now, which is probably why HBO is interested in adapting or continuing with this world. I think it was the first, not revisionist, what do you call it? A, sort of a cynical, commentary, not a parody, kind of a,
Well, the alternate timeline,
sort of,
that aspect.
Satire, it's satirical, it's, It was the first time I was shown that, you know, superheroes can be fallible. They can be people, that you can have characters with this much contradiction and complexity. And so going on from there, I think that really, I'm really glad I read it, because I think it sort of made me the kind of person who questions things and thinks about things and really analyzes things. And I think in this modern day and age where we're so bombarded with misinformation, that a book like Watchmen kind of shattered my naivety early. And I'm thankful for that. And
very cool.
Yeah. And then the movie came out when I was 17 and I was very hyped for it because, yeah, this is a book that had meant so much to me that it is sort of, I think it was one of those books that, well, like Catcher in the Rye, it's that important, that the essential teen book that takes a child into teenhood or adulthood. And I'm so glad it was Watchmen, because how cool is that?
Yeah.
And yeah, being the cynical douchebag teen I was, When the Watchmen movie came out, I definitely went along with that internet hive mind of, oh, the guy doing 300 is making it. Oh, they changed this, they changed that. Oh, there's no octopus. But that is so ironic that when I was 14, I was kind of more, well, I guess, fresh. It was just a fresh slate. It was tabula rasa. I was a kid who didn't have my preconceived notions of the world.
Mm-hmm.
And then by the time, you know, only 3 or so years later, I just become that typical internet geek who was very cynical and complained about nitpicky stuff. So I get it took me a long time to take what I had learned and then shape it into the person I am now, who is able to sort of stand back and be a little bit more analytical. And even reading Watchmen for the second time, or maybe third time, now, 10 years later, yeah, it really was mind-blowing. It was the same thing as revisiting Frankenstein, going, oh, there's way more nuance here than I thought. Right. There's way more here that 14-year-old me just wasn't prepared for. But I do think teens, young teens, need that kind of shock to the system, no pun there with Frankenstein, to just sort of get that ball rolling. Yeah, they might become douchebags and take the information the wrong way for a while, like, oh, Rorschach's so cool.
Yeah.
But actually, I think the scene that really encapsulates it all is, well, my personal journey, is not Ozymandias, but with Dr. Manhattan. Where, you know, Laurie keeps just, she's so frustrated going, but life is important and people are important and, you know, all these little things, it's not frivolous. Mm-hmm. Why would you just miss all, like, you think these, you know, neutrinos are so important, but you don't think the birth of a child is important? And I used to be like that. I used to be this cynical misanthrope. And then when I read that scene again, I have read it 3 times. I probably read it again when I was about 18 or 19.
Mm.
And reading that scene, just going, oh, you know, we, having that revelation with Dr. Manhattan realizing, wow, just the fact that, you know, the three of us are talking right now on this podcast, that we have this shared interest, that we are alive, that this even happened, that movies by minutes happened, Star Wars a minute happened, like, wow. Wow, life is really amazing, guys.
Yeah, so that's sort of.
So reading Watchmen the first time was just like, oh man, fuck the system, you know. I was a bit more of a Rorschach, I guess. Second time around, just going, life is beautiful and amazing, and we're all so lucky to be here, and I love everyone. And then the third time around, going, life is really complex, and no one's good, no one's bad. We're all trying to do our best. You know, Rorschach is willing to die for his cause. Ozymandias is willing to sacrifice so many people for what he thinks is right. And every character you could look at that way. So, Watchmen's really cool. To put it in, it is a very profound work of art. You know, say what you will about, you know, Alan Moore, especially in his later years, saying some kind of controversial things. But this really is one of the most important pieces of literature, that I can read it three times over a decade and have these very different experiences with it. I am so, so thankful for it, really.
Yeah. I've talked about that, I'm sure, a few times now, just the realization of stuff like this, that it does change. Like, you know, and believe me, once you get into your 30s, it's going to change more, you know.
Oh my God, that's not that far away. I'm scared.
it's an interesting piece that it, like you've said, like it changed from the first time you read it to the second time to the third, and it'll keep doing that.
So. Yeah, I really should read it once every 10 years. And then with Frankenstein, not to deviate too much, but reading it as a teenager, just thinking, wow, this is really cool. I appreciate this on a very base level of, this is the first sci-fi ever written. It's by a woman. There's so much history here. It's really cleverly written. This is great. And then I read it a few years later when my father left. He just up and abandoned my family.
Oh, wow.
And then going, yeah, and then this book really helped me through my issues with parents.
Sure.
And then I don't talk to any of my family anymore, sadly. I've not had any contact with my mother. That's not a great situation there, but for about 5 months, no contact whatsoever. And revisiting Frankenstein again, just really coming to terms with, someone gives you life, doesn't mean they owe you or you owe them anything, or they control you. It doesn't mean anything. You know, what matters is the people who are actually there, who are your friends, whoever created you. Doesn't matter. That's just nature. I just love that, that stories can have that power. And Prometheus, again, it sort of has those Frankenstein elements. So I'm realizing now that I like morally ambiguous blondes who have good sense and fashion. I like stories about daddy issues. I'm seeing some recurring themes. Yeah. A name drop. I did meet Dave Gibbons.
Oh wow!
And I would love to have the opportunity to do it again, because I met him when I was 17. I was so awkward and shy, and he signed my smiley face badge that I made myself. I was in a terrible Ozymandias costume, and my brother was in a terrible Rorschach costume. But he was so nice and sweet and just infinitely patient. And all I remember being able to say was, and this was at Supernova Comic Convention in Perth, and it was in the late afternoon of Sunday, so it was the end of the weekend, and no one was there. He was just sitting there, just sketching away. And, which, I mean, it's Dave Gibbons, guys. But, yeah, we just wandered up, and I remember, and I'm glad I at least got this out, that I just said, I love the scenes of New York when it was destroyed, you know, just that you didn't, and so many stories do this, movies especially, that you lose that human element, that suddenly human beings just become a mass of bodies. And you see that a lot in not good stories about World War II, Auschwitz, and all of that, that they don't show these victims as human beings, and I think that's a real shame. Whereas, yeah, just slowly making my way through those pages, it was so clear that he had put thought into every single one of those bodies, what they were doing at the time.
Right.
You know, they just wanted to go to a concert, or they were just in an argument with their girlfriend, or, you know, that he never lost the human tragedy of the tragedy.
Yeah.
And yeah, he I don't know. I don't think I said it as articulate as that. I was just like, I really like the scenes with.
Yeah. No, I get what you mean. They do such a good job of, and you think these ancillary characters throughout the first, you know, 11 chapters of the book don't matter. They're just background characters. But yeah, then at the end of the story, when you find out that what happens to them,
that's so why heartbreaking. They're there. There's a therapist. There's a lesbian couple. There's the two Bernies.
Yeah.
From the newsstand, that you realize in that moment, I've suddenly become invested in this people. And a lot of that has to do with how, the writing, but also the attention to detail of these characters, that he drew them in an empathetic way. I think a lot of comics, especially modern art, can look real crap and background characters just look real rough and inconsistent.
Yeah.
But no, he made sure there were people and I really appreciate that. So if Dave Gibbons ever hears this, at least I've said it in a mature and articulate way. Not, I really like Watchmen.
Will you sign my badge?
Basically, I didn't even think I was not blonde. I actually did bleach my hair blonde for a while because of Adrian and David. Don't do it. It's really difficult. It's so hard, but I think I just had my dark hair and a crappy costume. but yeah, I would love it if he came back to a convention. I guess he doesn't really have any need to because he was promoting Watchmen at the time.
Yeah.
I have good memory. Well, it's a memory that's changed over time, because at first I went, oh, so cool, I met Dave Gibbons. And then about 5 years later, oh God, that's so embarrassing. Oh my God. And now, having become the more mindful and chill adult that I am, I am like, that was really sweet. I'm really glad I had that moment. It didn't go to plan, but I was a kid. I think having that distance, it's sort of, I guess when you're only 5 years removed, it's the uncanny valley of, oh, I remember doing that and I should have known better. Yeah, but then you go about 10 years down the line and you just go, oh, I didn't have the maturity and knowledge that I have now. And yes, when I read Watchmen again, I will have that same experience again, probably, with reading it.
Yeah. I think you probably the only guest so far, at least that I'm aware of, that has met Dave Gibbons.
Woo! I got to meet some Canadian regulars. I've met someone involved with Watchmen. Bringing everything to the game. So I've talked your ears off. I know I do this even on my own podcast. If I'm just doing a podcast by myself, it's like 5 to 20 minutes. Get me on a show get me on a show with someone else, or put guests on my show. Suddenly I'm just, can't shut me up.
I think that's probably going to do it for this one.
Yeah, it has been an absolute pleasure. I didn't even, just writing the notes and doing research was such a great experience on a personal level, just to revisit this story. And as I mentioned before, the podcast as well has really helped with that.
Oh, good.
But having the experience of talking about it has been great too, and this has really been a great experience for me.
Oh, good. I know I've certainly enjoyed having you, and I'm sure Eric has as well.
Oh yeah.
You've been, I think, on our list, especially to have some Adrian minutes. I know for quite a while we've had you on the schedule, so I'm glad it. Glad we finally made it to this point, and it was great to having you on.
And I know Eric is keen to be on Prometheus by Minute, doing some engineer minutes.
Nice.
Which, yeah, so I'm now, I guess I could get to my promotion.
Yeah, set. Please.
I'm now no longer on hiatus. I had some health issues and financial issues. La 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 la. Grown-up stuff is scary, guys. But... now everything's under control. I've got some episodes coming up. So I guess, well, this episode you're hearing now, there'll probably be plenty of episodes for you to listen to, and we should be getting to the Eric minutes sometime next year. If all goes to plan, probably in the next 3 months, I think.
Very nice. And where can people find...
Oh, yes. I should probably do just assuming I'm so famous that everyone knows. So, traviandesigns.com is where you can find all my projects, TRAVIAN. So, I dabble in everything. So, there's podcasts. I've got two podcasts. There's Prometheus by Minute and also Saint Elsewhere, where I talk about depictions of autism in the media. That's about once a month or so, depending on my availability and my co-host, and it's a very full-on show.
Sure.
And that's really cool. And any sort of art projects and stuff I may be working on. And I also really into cooking right now, cooking really healthy, nutritious stuff. So I've started my other website, KetoMad, KetoMad.net. Which is a hybrid of keto and OMAD, one meal a day. And yeah, it's just talking about low-carb recipes, fasting, and the benefits of all of that. So if you're interested in that sort of stuff, I've also got that to check out.
Where do cold cans of beans kind of land on your...
Well, if there's no sauce... Very good for keto, actually. But the human bean juice, yeah, that you might want to check the label because it might contain gluten and it might be high in sugar, but I'm sure there's ways around that.
Oh, very cool. You can find us Twitter and Instagram at Watchmen Minute. You can search Watchmen Minute on TeePublic and find some merch to buy.
And we also have our Facebook page where you can like it at facebook.com/watchmenminute. And come join us in our group, the Crime Busters Listener Society.
Yeah, go check that out. It's a good group of people.
It is, yeah.
That is a handsome looking logo.
Thank you.
Yep, thanks to Travis.
Yeah, I don't know about my own, but it gets the job done.
All right, I think we will call this one an episode and come back tomorrow for minute 148. Again, Connor, thanks for joining us these past two episodes.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. So until tomorrow, who watches the Watchmen? We do.
We do.
We do.
Who keeps the metric system down?
Watchmen are over.